Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Who weathered Ermine better, Florida's governor or Tallahassee's mayor? Politics becomes electric in the aftermath of the first Florida hurricane in more than a decade.
You're the one that's going to be taking all of the heat because executive means the buck stops on your desk in the minds of the voters.
Also this week, Florida's governor is going to great lengths to take part in cleanup efforts after the storm.
Anytime that there's a natural disaster or an emergency and a governor shows strong leadership, it's a political plus.
After an unexpected week off to cover a whirlwind of storm activity and recovery in the area that contains the seat of state government, our team of reporters is back to bring you the latest. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Ermine is the first hurricane to strike Florida in more than a decade. The storm plunged nearly all of North Florida, including the state's capital city of Tallahassee, into darkness. Little by little, the lights have come back on, and they're now shining directly on a feud between a Republican governor trying to make a bigger national mark and a mayor considered a rising Democratic star. We get that story from Lynn Hatter.
Ermine downed hundreds of Tallahassee's trees, a feature of the city guarded closely by residents and officials alike. In the wake of the storm, Tallahassee's precious trees became her enemy, striking down power lines and slicing homes in half. As dawn crept over the skyline, the reality was worse than expected. Of the 150 main circuits that take power from stations to the lines, more than 110 had gone down.
Normally on a Friday morning like this, we would have 200 megawatts of load. It's 7 o'clock in the morning. We had 53 megawatts of load that Friday morning, and that was because of the amount of damage.
80% of Tallahassee was dark, but area residents rallied together, bringing each other food and water, huddling in homes and businesses that still had power. But by day three, problems began to emerge, with many wondering why nursing homes and a senior assistance community were still dark. Later in the day, Governor Rick Scott alleged the city of Tallahassee had turned down help from Florida Power and Light. A war of words ensued, which Mayor Andrew Gillum said was unhelpful.
Our citizens, at that time, we still had tens of thousands that were out of power. For them to perceive that there is some breakdown or dysfunction between their local responders and the state government is completely unhelpful.
The pace of recovery has now become a lightning rod for Gillum. Tempers have risen with the temperature, and with no air conditioning to cool them down, they've simmered. Gillum insists he did not turn down anything, but in a meeting, FPNL did offer help. Such decisions are made by Tallahassee's city manager and the utilities manager. The city's elected mayor actually has little power, but that does not matter to voters, says University of South Florida political scientist Susan McManus.
We have examples up north of snow removal problems where that's been the demise of a mayor. We have other instances of where fires and tornadoes and such in other parts of the country have been the demise of various elected officials. No surprise. We want our leadership to be responsive when we have true danger, and nothing is more dangerous than a huge natural disaster.
The mayor? I have seen him doing great work. I mean, he's new, and you have to give him a chance to, you know, accommodate to everybody. You know, I think he's doing a good job.
Angie Woodbury Footman is willing to give Gillum a break on the city's response, and she's also quick to acknowledge Governor Rick Scott.
And the governor as well. I work for him.
Oh, okay. Are you local here?
I live here.
Scott has been seen doing cleanups around town, speaking to residents, and expressing his dissatisfaction with the pace of power restoration. Now, Senate Appropriations Chief Jack LaValle is calling for a hearing on whether small, municipally owned utilities are equipped to handle storm recoveries. And it's these types of optics, says USF's McManus, that have a lasting impact on a politician's future.
But the bottom line is, when you're the chief executive, whether you're the mayor of a city, whether you're the governor, you're the one, or the head of the county commissioners, or what, you're the one that's going to be taking all of the heat, because executive means the buck stops on your desk in the minds of the voters.
Hurricane Hermine proved the first litmus test for both Scott and Gillum, and voters will ultimately decide who did it best as Scott mulls a bid for the U.S. Senate and Gillum continues to raise his own profile. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Len Hatter.
Florida Governor Rick Scott has been putting his shoulder into Hurricane Hermine response efforts, and we get that story from Nick Evans.
While local officials have stumbled, Governor Scott has, if not soared, at least made a positive showing. A politician well known for his wooden public speaking and dogged reliance on talking points has easily outshone the city and the county when it comes to disaster response. So, how'd he do it? Well, he hasn't become some great communicator. His delivery is just as rigid as ever. But in an echo of the workdays Democrats Bob and Gwen Graham have relied on to build political goodwill, the governor has been visible, present, taking an active role in helping residents get back to normal.
Are they signed?
That started Tuesday morning in a Department of Transportation parking lot. About 100 volunteers from state agencies are digging through boxes with gloves and reflective vests, while department official Brian Satterfield warns them to be careful at their work sites.
These are common injuries that we see.
The governor's group starts at a Baptist church in Southside, Tallahassee.
We have three groups where we are and where we are basically just cleaning up today. And so we have a lot of volunteers. We have veterans. We got volunteer National Guard members. We've got other just community volunteers. I've had a lot of friends that told me they're going to show up. We'll see. It's going to be a hot day, but we're just going to be cleaning up.
In a nearby neighborhood, the governor and a small team of volunteers start digging into piles of branches stacked along the street. In minutes, the bed of a pickup truck is full, but two much larger trucks are right behind it.
Hey guys, if somebody want to follow me down here, there's an empty truck.
In terms of actually setting the city to rights, the governor's effort is superficial. The team sent out Tuesday cleaned up three streets in a city of nearly 200,000 people. Fallen trees still line the curbs, and it will be weeks before all that debris is cleared. But in terms of elevating his standing with the local community, the governor's effort goes a long way.
You want to make sure that people understand that you know that they're suffering and that they want some relief. So I think that's first. And then secondly, you want to be seen as the leader of a competently run response.
That's University of North Florida political scientist Matthew Corrigan. And he's actually describing the disaster response playbook perfected by another GOP governor from Florida, Jeb Bush. Long before he was drummed out of this year's presidential race, Bush established his legacy with his active response to a total of 9 hurricanes.
Yeah, I think his poll numbers went up, and also it probably some of it happened, you know, during the presidential election in 2004, and I'm sure it helped his brother win the state as well, because the Bush name was out there in a positive light.
For years, politicos have opined Scott may have his eye on running for another office, senator or perhaps president, when his stay in the governor's mansion ends. And Corrigan says high marks after a natural disaster certainly doesn't hurt.
I mean, I think any time that there's a natural disaster or an emergency and a governor shows strong leadership, it's a political plus, and it allows... I'm not saying that's the reason he did it, but you know, it is a political plus, and I think that with that, that opens up more possibilities.
After cleaning up at three sites Tuesday, Scott followed it up with similar visits on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, reiterating his support for local residents in a largely blue county. And his rhetoric has been tame, staying away from explicit attacks on local officials. But with all these events, it seems Scott's race for 2018, or even 2020, may have begun. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a mass outpouring of public and private sector hurricane help for the capital city's neediest residents may still have come up short.
How do we ensure that the most vulnerable in Tallahassee, those seniors who rely on power for essential medical care, are high on the list of priorities in the event that something like this happens again?
Florida elections officials have completed a recount despite the hurricane.
We had anticipated that the storm would hit. We had emergency power here at the Voting Operations Center.
Florida barely dodged a primary election fiasco with the polls closing just 3 days before Hurricane Hermine washed ashore. But don't rest too easy. There's nearly three more months of hurricane season.
Nothing would surprise me. And so, you know, if we had a hurricane on election day, that would just be one more thing that we could talk about. Hey, only in Florida, who could have guessed?
And Hurricane Hermine isn't the only ill wind that blew through Florida this week.
They've been hit by a storm. It happens to be a healthcare storm, and it's hurting them economically.
Thousands of the most vulnerable seniors in Florida's Big Bend relied on a network of volunteer and professional caregivers, and sometimes each other, to weather Hurricane Hermine. Jim Ash reports some of the planning worked, but some didn't.
Westminster Oaks retirement community resident Barbara Johnson is the no-nonsense chair of the Emergency Preparations Committee. When Hurricane Hermine knocked out the lights and then the switchboard, Johnson's network of block captains kept most of the community's nearly 700 residents calm and informed.
Talked with a lot of daughters or other family relatives of residents who were obviously very concerned. Well, we had no idea when the power would come back on, and they were trying to make judgments about what they do about their loved one.
Some residents babysat so staff members could work round the clock. Westminster Executive Director Don Wilson said sheltering in place instead of evacuating was the right choice.
You don't just load them up and take them somewhere in Tallahassee. Where would we? Well, that would have overloaded the system. And it really didn't make sense to drive them to Gainesville or anything to bring in massive buses.
And elder care advocates agree sheltering in place worked, at least to the extent that there were no storm-related deaths or injuries. But Florida Healthcare Association Executive Director Emmett Reed says the Big Bend Disaster Recovery Plan has a big gap. By Sunday, four area elder care facilities were still waiting to have their power restored.
And as we were going into several days with facilities that were running on generator power, we were really one generator malfunction away from potential human tragedy.
Leading Age CEO Stephen Bamer, an advocate for Westminster and other nonprofits, doesn't call disaster response in the Big Bend an unqualified success either.
The officials were very responsive to us, and we appreciated that very much, but we still think that more could have been done sooner to alleviate the challenges that folks who are caring for seniors ran into.
Westminster administrators who were on site say nobody from the governor's office, the county, or the mayor's office called to check their status. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum blames a communications breakdown. He says he was satisfied Westminster survived after he met Sunday with Reed.
They are considered a vulnerable population, and they were priority. I was told that they had generation that was keeping them going until the lines could be successfully restored there.
But Reed says if Tallahassee's elder care facilities are considered a priority, then officials need to work on their definition. He says utilities in Southwest Florida were able to respond to centers there much quicker in Hermine's wake.
Again, I don't believe it was done intentionally. I think that there's that this was just a systemic issue that we're going to have to look at globally, and we're going to have to make improvements.
Department of Elder Affairs spokeswoman Ashley Chambers says some seniors were more than inconvenienced by the loss of power.
It's not just people complaining because they can't watch the football game. You know, these people need power to, you know, provide electricity for their oxygen machines, for their nebulizers. We had someone with severe asthma who had not been able to use her nebulizer for 5 days.
Gillum says he expects soon to begin a thorough review of disaster response. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
After several recounts and a hurricane, Florida's election results are official. Regan McCarthy has more.
8-6.
Mm-hmm. 4-5-8-6.
4-5-8-6. All right, Luther.
3-4-2-3.
Gary.
2-8-6. Leon County election officials are completing an audit of local elections. The idea is to ensure results are accurate. They're using software called Clear Ballot to count the votes, then comparing those numbers to the numbers tabulated by the traditional voting machines. Most numbers come out spot on. Some are one or even two votes different, but well within acceptable levels and nowhere near making a difference in any of the races. Here's Leon County Supervisor of Elections, Ion Sancho.
Now, the audit that we're doing today actually is permissive. We didn't have to do this because we did a full recount. And then if you do a full recount, you don't have to do the audit. But we like doing the audit. We like being able to recount 100% of every vote in every race on the ballot.
In Leon County, a close race between Democratic candidates for Congressional District 2 triggered an automatic recount, a requirement Sancho says came with a deadline immediately following Hurricane Hermine, a storm that knocked out power to most of Tallahassee.
We had anticipated that the storm would hit. We had emergency power here at the Voting Operations Center. And in fact, we continued the recount all day Saturday, even though all of the board members, none of them had power at their own home. We worked here.
Sancho says officials used generator power to complete the recount, finally heading home at 1 a.m. Then the Secretary of State called them back again.
The state transmitted a notice back to us saying that the margin is still within 0.25%, and now all the ballots that the machine at the machine recount could not read are being examined manually. This is now the manual recount to determine if any of these ballots that the machine says we don't see any votes, do they have votes on them?
If you listen carefully, you might hear the shuffle of paperwork in the background as employees work in teams, looking at each of the ballots and sorting them into categories. Most have no votes in this race, but some are unreadable by the machine because the voter used the wrong color of ink, or because one candidate is crossed out and another is circled. In that case, the ballots go before the local canvassing board, where officials determine voter intent. In the end, officials determined the outcome hadn't changed. Walter Dartland beat Democrat Steve Krapps in the primary. Dartland will face off against Republican Neil Dunn in the race for conservatively leaning Congressional District 2. Meanwhile, Leon County isn't the only elections office to conduct a recount. Every county that's part of District 2 held a recount, as did counties in southwest Florida, where just 75 votes separate winner Daryl Roussan and his greatest primary opponent, Ed Narain. Roussan is now the likely front runner in a race for a seat in the state Senate. He faces off against Republican John Howman in November. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Hurricane Hermine narrowly missed hitting Florida on primary election day, making landfall just 3 days after polls had closed. But Kate Payne wonders, what happens when elections take a rain check?
Hurricane Hermine brought 80-mile-per-hour winds, storm surge, and lots of downed trees, but no elections fiasco. The storm made landfall in St. Mark's just 3 days after polls closed. But just as the state has an emergency storm plan, there's an emergency elections plan as well. Chara Torres-Spellacy teaches election law at Stetson Law School. She says election day can be postponed in the event of a natural disaster, domestic emergency, or terrorist attack.
the governor can declare a state of emergency and can postpone an election for 10 days after it was originally scheduled or whenever is reasonably practical.
Then county elections officials go into overdrive, assessing the damage and organizing alternate polling places. Chris Chambliss is the president of the State Association of Election Supervisors. He says voting technology is a benefit in disaster situations, even if they have to pull out the backup generators.
So as the voter is processed through the electronic poll book, it produces the ballot as needed, specific for that individual and their registration. So it's far more doable today with technology than it was back then.
And there is some precedent for putting off elections. Chara Torres-Spellacy at Stetson experienced this firsthand 15 years ago on September 11th.
That was an election day for the city primary. And because of the attacks that happened early that morning, the mayor suspended the elections for that day.
And there's certainly evidence of storms bashing elections protocol, if not postponing them entirely. In late October 2012, Hurricane Sandy caused extensive flooding and $50 billion in damage, some to polling places. Hurricane Charley in August 2004 wreaked havoc on Southwest Florida as well. The hardest hit areas were forced to find new precincts, and presidential candidates cut their schedules in the state, spurring speculation of how the storm affected voter turnout and sentiment. Aubrey Jewett is a political science professor at the University of Central Florida.
Bad weather on election day, and particularly if it lasts for several days as you're heading into election day, it almost always depresses turnout, at least to some degree.
The odds of a hurricane making landfall on election day are pretty low. That being said, hurricane season does extend through the end of November, making it a possibility, however small. Fernita Tolson is a voting rights professor at Florida State's College of Law.
It is a possibility. Sandy didn't happen on election day either, but it happened really, really close to election day. And, you know, Hermine happened close to the primary. So all of these things are possibilities, but our policies only change in response to bad things actually happening.
The last really bad thing that actually happened in Florida politics? The presidential election in 2000, Bush versus Gore. As bizarre as the 2000 political storm was, Aubrey Jewett at UCF can't imagine a meteorological storm bashing the state as well.
After researching Florida politics for over 20 years, nothing would surprise me. And so, you know, if we had a hurricane on election day, that would just be one more thing that we could talk about. Hey, only in Florida, who could have guessed?
Election day is November 8th, and hurricane season ends November 30th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, after a relaxing recess of nearly 2 months, Congress is back in Washington, D.C., and people are hopeful there will be some agreement on what can be done to combat the Zika virus, which has already plagued more than 750 Floridians. As Sasha Cordner reports, that comes as the Senate failed to pass another Zika funding bill again this week, and there may be even more issues surrounding the mosquito-borne disease on the table.
I rise with about 100 mosquitoes straight from Florida. Aedes aegypti mosquitoes capable of carrying the Zika virus.
Holding a jar of mosquitoes on the House floor, Florida Congressman David Jolly called on his colleagues to do something to combat the Zika virus.
During the 7 weeks of August that we were gone, cases of Zika rose from 4,000 to, by some estimates, over 16,000 in the country, including a new non-travel-related case in Pinellas County, Florida.
Despite the Pinellas County case, most of the state's close to 60 local Zika transmissions have been in Miami-Dade County, particularly in the areas of Wynwood and Miami Beach, two tourist magnets. That's why Florida's Republican Senator Marco Rubio recently filed a bill to allow small businesses to get a loan from the Small Business Administration impacted by the Zika virus.
And if they had lost power or been hit by a hurricane or a tornado, this wouldn't be an issue, but they've been hit by a tornado of a different kind. One that they had no, they didn't cause, and they couldn't predict, and they couldn't insure against. and that is Zika.
He also filed a bill that gives the Department of Defense flexibility to move existing money around to provide protections for those deployed and impacted by Zika.
This is not a theory. We have over 100 people now, including 81 in uniform, that have been impacted by it, and 19 of their dependents, 3 of them that are pregnant.
And lastly, Rubio says both sides of the aisle need to set aside their differences and vote for a bill fully funding anti-Zika efforts. And he says while he's voted for every bill, Republican or Democrat or bipartisan in nature, he's most in favor of the $1.1 billion proposal the Senate voted on months ago. And Florida's Democratic Senator Bill Nelson feels the same way. He says it's time to stop the political games because the Zika problem is getting worse, especially in Florida.
The problem is the over 80 females in Florida that are pregnant that also have the Zika virus. You've seen photos of these terribly deformed children. It's such a tragedy, not only for the family, but is a considerable expense.
Nelson recently voted against a House measure that's now failed 3 times. It's been blocked by U.S. Senate Democrats because the proposal has included controversial provisions like defunding birth control services associated with Planned Parenthood and reversing a ban on flying the Confederate flag in military cemeteries. Still, Governor Rick Scott says both chambers and the president need to find a way to work together on this. Scott was supposed to go to Washington, D.C. when Congress came back in session to talk about Zika funding, but had to cancel due to Hurricane Hermine's impact on Florida.
You know, the president and Congress have to figure out how to come together and get this done. This is it. Zika is an issue for this country. It's an issue. It's an international issue. It's not just a Florida issue. I don't want any additional cases in Florida, and the federal government needs to step up and be a partner. They have not been a partner. I still have outstanding requests for the CDC that I've had out for, seems like, weeks now.
In the meantime, Florida lawmakers have sent a bipartisan letter on behalf of incoming state House leadership asking the federal government to declare a public health emergency in Florida and allow the state to make use of certain technologies that could help prevent further in-state Zika transmissions. That includes allowing local communities to decide if they want to release genetically modified mosquitoes. Meanwhile, other areas are looking into options like the aerial spraying of insecticides. The spraying of Nolid particularly sparked controversy in Miami Beach. That's where about 100 people protested a city commission workshop weighing whether the effects of spraying Nolid were worse than the Zika virus itself. But protester Maria de Los Angeles says their concerns weren't heard.
So we just had this public meeting with government officials and CDC experts and doctors, and strangely enough, there was no one who was an expert on the effects of Nolid here. So in conclusion, this was a very biased meeting, and the locals are still very concerned, and there's really nothing we can do about it.
And after delaying it by a day, the spraying of Nolid still went ahead early Friday. Several cities in Broward County are expected to be sprayed as well on Monday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Kortner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport, and please join us again next week for more reports from the State Capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.